Hi, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the latest in the series of Investec teleconferences on the coronavirus and the economy. I'm Philip Shaw. I'm the Chief Economist at Investec in London, and I'm your host again today. Our guest this week is another of my colleagues at Investec, Jens Winfried. Jens works in our securities area as an analyst covering the healthcare sector, and he's actually a relatively recent recruit, having joined at the start of the year from N+1 Singer. Before being involved in financial markets, Jens practiced as a medical doctor for several years, having qualified at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. Good morning, Jens.
Good morning.
This morning, we'll follow the familiar format of a brief update on the economy and markets from myself, and followed by a run by Jens on healthcare and I think the pharmaceutical sector as well. And of course, at the end, as previously, we'll be opening up the forum to questions and answers. On the economy, I know a number of you are regulars at this teleconference, so I'll try not to repeat too much beyond the key points. And one of those is that our broad view of the economy is that after a 2% decline in GDP on the quarter, in the first quarter, this will be followed by a drop in excess of 25% in Q2, of course, due to the lockdown. But as the restrictions are eased over the second quarter and perhaps the third quarter, Q3 sees a big rebound in the economy, but not one that takes us to where the level of activity, the level of GDP was before the pandemic. As I mentioned last week, we do not call this a U-shaped recovery. We call it a lopsided V-shaped recovery. And we're really pleased over the past few days to hear both the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, Ben Broadbent, and the Chief Economist at the BOE, Andy Haldane, also refers to the path as a lopsided V. So economists are beginning to agree on something, even if it's the shapes of letters. As those of you who are in the UK will know at least, there has been some modest easings of the restrictions. On Monday, some primary school children will go back to school and will get a very limited set of outlets, such as outdoor markets and car showrooms reopen as well. But the bigger date, the more significant event on this front is the 15th of June, when the remainder of non-essential retail is allowed to start trading again. Now, decisions have not yet been made on the entertainment sector, so for example, pubs, restaurants, etc., but the broad shape of developments is effectively as we thought and we have been trying to model. The other thing which the health secretary mentioned yesterday is that if it looks as though there is a local flare-up in the virus, the government will impose a local lockdown in selected areas as well. So that is new news that we heard yesterday. Looking at economic developments over the past week, it was a very heavy week for economic data last week. In short, what the figures have been saying is that March activity was very bad in the UK. April has been even worse. So, for example, here we learnt of an 18% month-on-month fall in retail sales volumes in April. And in terms of the surveys which we're getting, which we're actually looking at the pace of activity in May, obviously the current month, they are showing some signs of an upturn here. And broadly, this is a pattern over the rest of Europe as well, and also the US. And when we check that through with some of the anecdotal indicators that we look at, such as the amount of travel and electricity production as well, that is broadly saying the same thing, i.e. that the pace of activity, or the level of activity rather, bottomed out in early April, and we're seeing a very, very gradual, perhaps even glacial increase up to the current day. One question is whether the data and the events over the past 7 days changed our view. As I hinted before, in terms of the broad shape, no. What we're factoring into the second quarter, which is a quarter-on-quarter decline in GDP of around 27%, to us looks about right, though it's obviously difficult to tell exactly. A 30% recovery in Q3 may be a little bit too strong, and we could well factor some delay of that bounce back in activity into the final quarter of the year, i.e. Q4, particularly because the government is insisting on practicing social distancing for longer. But in very general terms, the outlook seems to be the same as we have gauged over the past few weeks, i.e. that the economy will recover. It is already recovering, but we'll see more visible signs over the third quarter. But it will be struggling to get to pre-pandemic levels of activity or GDP, and we actually don't think that that is going to be achieved by the end of next year. Certainly, the timing and the intensity of any rebound will depend on the success of various technical factors such as track and trace and the availability of a vaccine. I'm sure that's something which Jens will speak about in a minute. On the policy outlook, we talked about the Bank of England potentially considering negative interest rates last week, and that debate certainly seems to be ongoing. It's not our central case that the Bank of England takes interest rates into sub-zero territory. Our base case is that the bank rate, or the base rate, as it's sometimes known, will stay at 0.1%. It's all-time low so far for a considerable period of time. And our feeling is that there are ways, if the Bank of England wants to lower rates, that it can do that without cutting the base rate below zero. And one such method would be to reduce rates on some of its schemes. And one of those is something called the TFSME, which the Bank of England lends to banks under, on condition that the banks pass that on to the private sector. And it's one way of easing policy by stealth, if you like. And it's something in a similar move which the European Central Bank has been doing on one of its schemes. It's actually called the TLTRO 3 scheme. But it's not impossible overall that the bank rate is brought down below 0%. On the QE side, our view is still that we will get an expansion of bond buying or money printing, or whatever you'd like to call it, after the next Bank of England announcement on the 18th of June. I'd just like to mention Dominic Cummings recently, and we are all entitled to our views on what Mr. Cummings did or didn't do. But one point is that if he resigns or is forced to resign, one knock-on effect may be that the UK takes a less hawkish, less aggressive line in its trade talks with the EU, which on many fronts appeared to have stalled since they were resumed a few weeks ago. Looking at the wider data, and how are we doing on coronavirus stats? Well, in the UK, both daily fatalities and the number of reported cases are falling, and with the latter, that's despite a greater amount of testing than previously. And the respective numbers are around a total of 37,000 reported deaths and 265,000 reported cases. Looking more widely, globally, again, last week we spoke about various countries bucking the falling trend, and Brazil is still rising, both in terms of the number of daily deaths and reported cases. And indeed, in terms of the reported cases, it's moved up to about 395,000 now, which means that it is second globally behind the United States. Other problem spots include Russia, where fatalities are still increasing, but the number of cases apparently seems to be on the decline. And in the States, deaths are still falling. Cases are still edging down, but there isn't a massive decline in the number of fatalities there in the US. Very briefly on markets, on sterling, the pound has been trading in a relatively narrow range against the US dollar in May so far, between somewhere around 121 and 125. We've got push and pull factors here, and the biggest ones are, number one, on the downside, negative rates and the thoughts that the bank rate may be pulled below zero, and that's been something which, of course, has been undermining sterling. On the positive side, you know, what happened with Dominic Cummings over the bank holiday weekend means that there's some upward pressure on sterling. As I said, it's thought that if Mr. Cummings does resign, then the UK's tactics with the EU trade negotiations may become softer. There perhaps becomes a greater chance of the transition period being extended, and therefore that has been pushing sterling up over the last 24 hours or so. On the negative rate front, UK markets have actually been factoring in a risk of rates going negative towards the end of this year and in early 2021. And also, if you look at the government bond markets, like the gilt market, the government last week sold three-year paper at negative yields last week. That's the first time ever. And if you look at the structure of the gilt yield curve, five-year gilts are also now yielding negative returns, and 7 years are at zero. Now, that obviously has been driven mainly by the debate over negative rates, but it's also been helped by the heavy pace of bonds buying, the quantitative easing program, where the Bank of England is buying on average over 13 billion of paper each week. And that's greater than the government is selling. So in conclusion, we do feel still that the economy will bounce back in the second half of this year, but again, only to a limited extent. And economic conditions, we feel, aren't going to be easy for quite some time. And the obvious comment is that the outlook will depend very much on how the restrictions are lifted. The government clearly wants to avoid a big second wave in terms of the coronavirus outbreak, and perhaps much there depends on test and trace, vaccine, potentially a viral cure, e.g. remdesivir, and this is probably a very good point to bring in Jens. Jens.
Thank you, Philip. So my name is Jens Lindqvist, and as Philip mentioned, I'm the senior healthcare analyst at Investec. Normally, I would be asked to talk about biotech and pharmaceutical stocks, but this time I've been asked to give a few thoughts on the COVID exit scenario, including a view on potential vaccines becoming available. But as Philip mentioned, I did practice medicine in Sweden before joining the city about 20 years ago. So I might start off with that briefly now that the UK lockdown is being gradually lifted, initially roughly to the same level as Sweden, where schools up to year 9, restaurants, shops and hairdressers have stayed open, although with some restrictions to avoid overcrowding. So far, this hasn't really worked for Sweden, which has one of the highest COVID death tolls per capita in the world. I think it's over 22 deaths per 100,000 population. And this is in spite of very low population density, much lower than, for example, Denmark. More established working from home practices and a unique majority of single households. The Swedish government has admitted to getting it wrong, very wrong, when it comes to nursing homes and patients in long-term care, and it's an independent review being called for in that area. It has so far not really worked in economic terms either. The Swedish central bank is projecting a 6.9% contraction for this year, a partial rebound, 4.6% in 2021, which I believe is broadly in line with the projections by its Scandinavian neighbours. However, the Swedish government is saying that containing COVID is a marathon, it's not a sprint. The outcome should be measured over years and not months, and this may, of course, have a point. A recent study suggested that 26% of people in Stockholm have been infected by the virus, which will be equivalent to around 75 people infected for every confirmed case. And if it turns out that herd immunity is the only way to contain this virus over the long term, then this may still prove to have been the best strategy. Sweden did scale its healthcare system to cope, and on the whole, it has coped. And an interesting point here is that the Swedish law mandates that the government's response to major disease outbreak is based on best science, which is why the public debate is focused very much on the public health agency, the local name of which is almost unpronounceable, as opposed to the elected government. So the PHA is effectively determining the government's response. I think a real test for the containment will be the Midsummer's Eve festivities that are coming up in late June. Every restaurant tends to be fully booked and large gatherings are par for the course. It is about as far from social distancing as one can get, and I think there's a strong possibility that additional restrictions will be imposed before then, or we will see a further rise in the number of cases. Now, getting back to the UK, I think as we exit the lockdown gradually, I think it is inevitable that we will see a great variance in the implementation and monitoring of safety measures between companies in the UK. if you look at the China as a comparison, how it's partially exited its lockdown, there was much less room for variation because the local government plays a very active role in managing compliance, you know, through daily reporting, spot checks, and very steep fines for non-compliance. The exit policies were also very much more detailed than what can be expected in the UK. You know, as an example, office-based businesses in China are still obliged to provide a certain number of mouth protections for staff, to disinfect high-touch points and common areas twice daily, and perform regular temperature checks of staff. Some companies even provide boxes of tissues by the lifts to use, you know, for when pressing the lift buttons. I suspect few businesses in the UK will be prepared to take it quite that far. But are we at risk for continued transmission, local outbreaks, perhaps even a second COVID wave? I think this will largely depend on three factors, being organizational behavior, the effectiveness of test and trace, as Philip mentioned, and thirdly, obviously, the possibility of a vaccine. I think with regards to organizational behavior, my view is that this represents a major challenge. Yeah, modern open plan offices are designed for human interaction, and modern management is based on keeping doors open. At Investec, we pride ourselves of having not only an open plan office, but an open plan culture, you know, that we believe on good grounds to be good for business. However, it's not the ideal solution for disease containment. So I think we, like all companies in the UK, will have to think very carefully about how we manage human nature to avoid just what we've been actively trying to promote. As a test and trace, needless to say, this effort is meant to partially replace the lockdown. It's expected to go live on the 1st of June. Again, this is something that China started doing very early on. Anyone traveling on public transport had to provide a mobile number, and an automated alert would then be sent to someone in that same train carriage later tested positive. And I hear this still applies for restaurants in China, for example. You can only enter if you provide your name and a mobile number, which must then be kept on record by the restaurant. Undoubtedly, personal data protection laws make this impossible in the UK. So the only solution to tracing anonymous contacts, you know, is for all of us to download an app that registers who we've been close to for a period of time. I think if properly implemented and combined with a testing effort to catch non-symptomatic spreaders, of whom there are many, this could prove very effective. But we need to know where the virus is to catch it. You know, it needs to be combined with a large-scale testing and proximity detection for test and trace to work. And again, if we see ultimately that the number of infected people is 75 times the number of confirmed cases as suggested in Stockholm, then test and trace will have very limited value because so many will be caught by it and will be back in lockdown. And this finally then brings us to the topic of vaccines. The virus was identified on the 7th of January. The genetic sequence of the virus was revealed in China on the 11th of January, which is astonishingly quick. Now, through the rest of January, many scientific collaborations were formed between Chinese academia and research bodies in the West, including Oxford University. And the proteomics work was completed as sort of a collaborative global effort, you know, including the identification of the now famous spikes on the virus and the enzyme that is used by the virus to create them. And with this knowledge in hand, you know, many companies, as you know, are developing COVID vaccines. According to a recent paper in Nature, 78 vaccines are currently in active development. These break down into sort of three broad groups based on which technology they use. You know, the first group of vaccines uses an inactivated or weakened form of the virus itself. Many approved vaccines are made this way, you know, including those for measles and polio and a few others. These require extensive safety testing. Because there is at least a theoretical risk that the virus could correct the changes made to it and regain its ability to replicate. You also need a lot of the virus and very biosecure facilities to make the vaccine. On a positive note, they have a very high propensity to trigger an immune response, which is known as immunogenicity. At least seven teams around the world at the moment are working on live vaccines, the lead one being Sinovac in Beijing. Animal data was published in early May. As it looks pretty good. It's the best we've seen so far, but it has no human data yet. The second group of vaccines uses the proteins from the virus, typically the spikes, you know, either on their own or packaged in some form of molecular container, like a virus-like particle, or DLP. A protein vaccine is in clinical trials at the moment from Novavax in the US. and a handful of teams are working on VLP solutions, but most of these are still quite early stage. And then finally, and this is the major group of vaccines, they're based on delivering in a variety of ways only a string of genetic code from the virus, typically the one coding for the spike protein. Once the genetic sequence has been taken up by cells in the body, the spike protein is expressed on the cell surface and then for the immune system to attack and memorize. No currently approved vaccines are actually made this way, but it's safe, and the technology is proven in gene therapy, and it's proving the technology most developers are now using to find a COVID vaccine. That includes Moderna, Inovio in the US, J&J in the US, BioNTech in Germany, AstraZeneca here in the UK, of course, and CanSino Biologics in China. On the clinical data so far, in my view, what we've seen so far is underwhelming. Antibody responses for the Moderna vaccine, they were comparable with those seen after a COVID episode, but these are generally quite low and not expected to be 100% protective. The CanSino vaccine showed immunogenicity in so far the biggest data set released by any company, but it uses a virus vector against which there is sometimes existing immunity, which could limit the protective performance. And finally, the monkey data on the AstraZeneca vaccine show that there were as many viral particles in vaccinated as in non-vaccinated monkeys in the nasal passage, passages following the viral challenge, suggesting that the vaccine may not prevent spreading of the virus, even if it does prevent pneumonia. Several companies, Moderna, AstraZeneca, J&J, they are now establishing manufacturing capacity for billion doses each. But regulatory approval is at least a year out, probably more. It is possible that risk groups, maybe including care workers, could be vaccinated earlier. But even this would require substantial phase 2 data, which is expected over the next couple of months for the lead vaccines and followed by regulatory review. So in summary on vaccines, there's a huge effort underway. Vaccines are not easy to develop. The data is so far pretty limited and, in my view, fairly unconvincing, and safety is paramount. If we really are discussing a billion or more doses being used in the fight against COVID, a serious side effect rate of only 1 in 10,000 could be disastrous. So, and remember, the first rule of medicine is do no harm, and a faulty vaccine could do real harm, and it could undermine the confidence in childhood vaccines, which save millions of lives. So I would be surprised if a vaccine becomes widely available before the middle of next year, at the very earliest. And that's all for me at this stage. Thank you for listening, and back to Philip.
James, thanks a lot for that. That was really, really interesting. I'm sure you could have spoken for quite a lot longer. There's obviously a lot of very relevant material in your sector to speak about. One thing that you didn't mention was the pharmaceutical sector and how that's been coping during the outbreak. So before I hand over to more general Q&A, would you like to speak about that?
Yes, I can do briefly. On the whole, the sector has held up very well. Companies directly involved in the fight against COVID, be it developers of vaccines or drugs, have benefited from large government grants, lots of investment, and fairly positive share price developments as well. From an operational point of view, millions of people depend on the supply of drugs. So it is a regulatory requirement that supply chains are designed to be robust, with dual source manufacturing and buffer inventory in place. So the negative impact has mainly been on the clinical trial side of things. We've got hundreds of large trials postponed, which has impacted the whole ecosystem of pharmaceutical services providers. Strategically, though, not much has really changed. Pharma companies are not able to easily pivot. So unless you were in the antiviral or vaccine space already, it does not really represent a new opportunity. So for the sector as a whole, with a few major exceptions, it has largely been business as usual.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we're ready now to hand back over to Molly, who will give you instructions on how to submit a question.
Please stand by. We do have a question.
Good morning. Thank you for that presentation. This was mainly a question for Phil. You mentioned negative rates earlier. I was wondering if you could delve a bit deeper into the main implications of these, please.
Yes, thank you for your question. The idea of bringing rates down, of course, is to stimulate spending. So the lower rates are, the less you'll save, the more you'll borrow and spend, and you'll help to drive a recovery. We've never had rates in negative territory. Rates are negative in the euro area. They have been negative in Sweden, and they're negative in Switzerland, and arguably Japan as well. One of the issues, and we can learn from the experiences of those jurisdictions, is that it really hurts the banking sector. And this happens in a number of ways. Firstly, it compresses the margin between lending rates and deposit rates, because unless banks can actually charge actively depositors for putting their deposits in the bank, then that's going to hurt. The second point is that if banks effectively take deposits, they borrow short and lend long, if longer term rates are a lot lower, then again, that's another factor compressing margins. And the third, more technical factor is that because of quantitative easing, there is an enormous amount of liquidity that commercial banks have to park at the Bank of England. And for example, if they are having to pay 0.15% to park their liquidity at the central bank, that's going to adversely affect their capital. Now, why should we care about the banks? We care about the banks because they are the center of the financial system and absolutely essential in maintaining corporate and household cash flow. And one of the things we have seen, particularly in March, was a large amount of borrowing from corporates, borrowing from the banks, again, to preserve their cash flow. So you have to be very careful, I think, in saying we will lower rates below zero. There are a lot of technical factors, but one particular area that the Bank of England will be looking at is what the impact is on the financial system.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't think that we have any more questions, and I think we have lost the host as well. I think we've lost Molly. So I will just wrap up by thanking Jens Lindqvist a lot for his presentation. It's really very instructive to hear a good first-hand account of what's happening in a different country, such as Sweden. We do hear snippets from the UK press and the UK media about, well, the system in Sweden has worked very well, why can't we do it here? I think Jens dealt with that question, that issue very well. And of course, for putting across and conveying an enormously technical subject in terms that we can all understand very well. So Jens, thank you enormously for that. And thank you very much to everybody else for attending, and we hope to speak to you soon. Thanks very much. Goodbye, and keep safe.